All right, so now we've talked about some of the effects. Let's talk a little bit more detail about what it means for our patient and for you in taking care of that patient. First thing is the respiratory depression. Now, what do we say respiratory depression is? Okay, decreased respirations and less than what? Less than 12. What's going to be severe? Less than 6. All right, so if it's less than 12, as long as the person is now in health assessment yesterday, what do we say was one of the signs that a person was doing okay in terms of respiratory function? What do we say would happen if you gave a person too much oxygen who was on COPD? What would they do? Stop breathing, and then, but how would they die? They would just go to sleep. So if you have a patient who's got respiratory depression, as long as they're alert or can be easily woken, probably aren't going to do anything more than just not give them anymore until they until their respiratory rate recovers. Yes, but our goal isn't to kill the patient just yet. So as long as the patient is either awake or can be easily awoken, you're not really going to do anything other than just monitor the patient and not give them anymore. Now, if the patient is unresponsive or if their breathing rate goes below 6, then you're going to intervene. And what's the most likely way you're going to intervene? Say again? Okay, not by giving them oxygen. What we want to do is we want to speed up their breathing rate. How can we speed up their breathing rate? Give them a drug. Okay, that's a good, very good answer. Which drug would we give? Do we have an antidote? Do we have an antidote to opiates? Yes, we would give an inhibitor, an antagonist. And what would that be? You mentioned it in passing just at the end of yesterday's class. Starts with an N. Naloxone, better known as Narcan. Now, in order to give Narcan, what do you need? Say it again. You need an order from a physician. Now, a lot of hospitals will not allow physicians to write an order for an opiate without also writing an order for naloxone. So that way the nurse doesn't have to hunt down the doctor and have the patient die while they're waiting for the doctor to return the call. Or call a code and send them to the ICU for something that can be fixed with a simple injection. So when are you going to intervene? What are the two circumstances?
Respiratory below 6.
Or if the respirations are below 12 and you can't arouse the patient. All right, now, when you give morphine, it takes about 4 or 5 hours for the respiratory depression to really set in. So one of the things we have to be careful about is that, you know, you give the drug, and you don't necessarily expect them to be respiratorily depressed for an hour. You know, so you don't come back 30 minutes later, oh, he's okay, I don't have to check on him the rest of the day. You need to make sure that about 4 hours later, that's when you really need to be the most careful, because that's when it's really going to start the worst.
What was the antagonist drug again?
Naloxone, Narcan. Yeah, yesterday you said, oh yeah, Narcan. Do you remember that? Okay. So don't give, and you don't give the next dose if the respiratory rate is less than 12. Constipation. What can we do about the constipation? Did you have something there, Stephanie?
Give them a laxative.
Okay, you could give them a laxative. All right, now what is the problem with in the constipation? What's happening? Okay, so reduced peristalsis, so we're slowing down the GI tract. As the GI tract slows down, it allows more time for what to happen to that stool? sort of fluid to be absorbed from that stool. So you end up with a hardened rock at the end. Now, how do we prevent that? More water. Make sure the patient stays well hydrated. You can also give what we call a stool softener, which is a kind of laxative. We'll talk more about those next semester. That allows more water to stay in the stool. Now, what else promotes GI function? Ambulation, walking around. So you want to make sure that your patient, even if they're post-op and in pain, well, first of all, we're going to get them out of pain by giving them morphine or other opiates. And then we want to make sure we walk them around to make sure that their bowel function stays preserved. Now, if a person has had surgery and they've been in anesthesia, what happens to their intestines during that anesthesia portion? It doesn't work. It kind of just goes to sleep and it stops functioning altogether. One of the most important things we want to make sure about in the hospital is in a patient who's post-op that they're having adequate bowel function. And the most important thing in that regard is to get them up and walking. All right. Next, we have urinary retention. Now, is this a good thing, urinary retention? No, why not? Because it can allow infections to occur. So the way we're going to fix this one is we're simply going to encourage the patient to
void.
Void is a fun word to say urinate. So even if the person says, no, I don't have to go, they're going to say, yes, I know, Mr. Jones, you don't have to go because I gave you morphine. So I want you to try and go. You can also give eyes and nose. What is eyes and nose? Ins and outs. So you're going to measure the amount of water that goes into them as well as the amount of water that comes out. And if, say, they've drunk 2 liters of water and they've only put 500 cc's of urine out, you know that, there might be a problem. For the cough suppression, we are going to encourage our patients to cough. We're also going to assess their lung sounds. If a person has excess sputum, what lung sound might we hear? Not crackles. That's fluid in the lungs. Okay, could be wheezing, but what do we have a breath sound that's dedicated to excess sputum? Sounds like snoring. Ronchi or ronchus. Oh, by the way, so long as we're on the subject, encouraging patients to cough is one of the most important things that we do as nurses. What do we say is collapse of the lungs? Or not the lungs, but collapse of the alveoli. What's the word for that? It's an A word. Atelectasis. So atelectasis is collapse of the alveoli. And why do we say that happened? Why do we say that happened? What causes the atelectasis? Say again. Not so much negative pressure, but it's just a lack of deep breathing. Remember we said, you know, sometimes elderly people don't breathe very much, and so you ask them to take a deep breath, and it opens their alveoli back up. Now, after surgery, what is a person in? Good, say it, the P word. Pain, yes, they're in pain. Now, imagine for a moment that you just had your gut slit open. Is it going to be painful to breathe? Yeah, so what are you going to do? Very short little breaths. Don't make it move. Don't let it hurt. Must stop the pain. Now, what's that going to do to their lungs? What's the A word? Atelectasis. That breathing very shallowly is going to make sure their lungs never really inflate. So what's going to happen is their alveoli are going to begin to collapse. That can lead to pneumonia. That is what aspirometer is for. So what we're going to do as nurses is a couple things. First thing we're going to do is what's the big topic for today? The P word. Pain. We are going to make sure they have good pain management. That's going to make them more likely to feel comfortable breathing. The next thing we're going to do is we're going to ask them to take deep breaths and cough. So having the patient breathe deeply and cough and have them walk, what's that going to do when you make them walk? Well, I mean, in terms of breathing, what's it going to make them do when they walk? They're going to have to breathe more deeply because they're exerting themselves. At the same time, if you're lying down, what's happening to the tissue that you're lying on? It's being squished. So you can actually compress lung tissue through the chest wall just by putting weight on it. So if you spend all day in bed, you get something we call compression atelectasis, just because you've been putting your weight on that part of the lung. So by getting the patient up, guess what you're doing? You're relieving that pressure. So in terms of just general nursing care, getting a patient out of bed, providing adequate pain management, having them cough and having them breathe deeply are some of the most important things that we can do to prevent illness, especially in what kind of patient? Post-operative patients. But that really goes for anyone who's in the hospital. All right. The next clinical consideration, the biliary colic, there's really nothing we can do about it except stop giving them morphine and try a different drug. So not all opioids are going to cause this problem. So what you want to do is you want to try and look for a drug that's not going to. It's extremely painful, and the problem is if you give them more morphine to try and take away the pain, you increase the colic, thereby increasing the pain. That didn't work, did it? For emesis, there's two things we can do. We can give them anti-emetics, drugs to prevent nausea and vomiting, or we can try decreasing the dose, but then they have pain. So what would we want to try instead? What was the suggestion right above that one? Try a different drug. So again, some drugs do not have as much of a tendency to cause nausea and vomiting as morphine. Now, here's an interesting one. Increased cranial pressure. Morphine can actually cause increased cranial pressure because it causes that venous dilation. It can cause excess pressure in the brain. Now, if there's excess pressure in your arm, What happens to those veins? What do they do? They expand. Where? Outwards. Now, as they expand outwards in the brain, what are they doing? They're squeezing brain tissue. Now, is that a good thing? No. Why isn't it a good thing? Well, because your brain doesn't like to be squeezed, and it can damage the brain tissue. So the key thing here is in a patient who's had a head injury, you want to use opioids with extreme caution, because if they have increased cranial pressure from their injury and then you give them an opioid, guess what you can cause? Well, actually, not just an opioid, but you give them morphine, guess what you can cause? Brain damage. The euphoria and dysphoria. Euphoria is what most patients will get. I feel good. Now, some people will get that very, very mildly. Some people won't get it at all. Some people will be like, I have never felt better than when I am on morphine. Now, what's the one thing we have to be careful of with a patient like that? Well, yes, could get addicted. But, I mean, in terms of assessment, what do we have to be careful about? Well, let me ask you this question. You've been in pain for the last 10 years. And you've been trying all kinds of different pain medications. You tried Tylenol, you tried hypnosis, you tried acupuncture, and finally your doctor gives you enough morphine to where you don't hurt. How are you going to feel? This is the best day of my life! I've never felt this good ever before. And it has nothing to do with euphoria, it just has to do with you don't feel pain. So one of the things you have to be very careful about with pain patients in terms of euphoria is, do they feel so good just because they're not in pain? Or do they really feel above and beyond that a true euphoria? So that's when we assess patients, we want to try and take a look at that. There's actually a drug, It was a neurological drug that didn't affect feelings at all. It just affected the way nerves work. And people who had a particular nerve disorder where they were in constant pain had so much pain relief that they said, I feel wonderful, I feel great, I've never felt this good in like years. And so it became a controlled substance just because they said, well, that's euphoria. But it wasn't really euphoria, it was just the patients didn't have pain. So again, goes back to our assessment skills. Now, dysphoria. What is dysphoria again? Okay, depression, bad feelings. Now, this is what we might refer to in the street as a bad trip. Yeah. So you take the drug, you expect to feel good, but instead of feeling good, you feel bad. You feel lousy. You feel depressed. That's dysphoria. Now, dysphoria is not as common, but it will happen in some patients. So if that happens, we want to make sure we monitor the patients. Consider trying them on a different drug. Definitely let the physician know. See if there's something else we can do for that patient. Now, sedation makes patients sleepy. Want to make sure that we institute good fall precautions to help prevent them from falling down when they try and get up to go to the bathroom, because you let them go 8 hours without going, and even with their urinary retention, after 8 hours, they got to go. Miosis, want to keep the room light. All right, now let's talk about pharmacokinetics for a moment. Getting this drug into a person's body. If we give it to them by the enteral route, what do we mean by that again? So by mouth or per rectum, although it's not as common to give morphine per rectum. But if we give it to them by mouth, it's going to take more drug to get the same effect, and it's going to take longer for that drug to get absorbed. So if we want immediate pain relief, do we want to give it orally? No. It lasts about 4 to 5 hours in its short-acting or regular form. And if there's some sustained release versions that release just a little bit at a time, and those will last 12 hours. Now, who here has heard of OxyContin? Now, what do you think OxyContin is? Okay, it's an extended release oxycodone. The word contin is short for continuous. So, continuous release. So, we have morphine contin, which is called MS contin. The S stands for sulfate, morphine sulfate contin. So, MS contin is a continuous release morphine that lasts approximately 12 hours. Morphine does not cross the blood-brain barrier very well. Question?
In the hospital, do they give like the Oxy-IR or the faster?
It's not necessarily for faster. See, the we'll talk about OxyContin in a few minutes. So hang on with that question. Distribution. Morphine does not cross the blood-brain barrier very well, which means that it doesn't cause that much euphoria. Now, if you want to know what heroin is just a carrier molecule for morphine. Heroin crosses the blood-brain barrier like crazy, which is why you can't give it by mouth. Remember, a lot of times if you give something by mouth that gets absorbed easily in the stomach, it's not going to be easily absorbed in the brain. So in this case, heroin doesn't get absorbed well in the stomach, but it gets absorbed by the brain like crazy. Once it's in the brain, it becomes morphine. So heroin is nothing more than a delivery mechanism for morphine. Most of the morphine is actually going to be in the blood and in the periphery. Now, is that going to cause more or fewer side effects? Periphery, like peripheral nervous system. It's going to cause more side effects, more constipation, more urinary retention, more venous pooling. It's metabolized by the liver. There's a fairly strong first pass effect, which is one of the reasons why if you give it by mouth, you have to give a higher dose. And in liver disease, you need to lower the dose of the morphine. All right. Now, we have a little graph here with three different lines. One very small little wiggly line, one medium-sized wiggly line, and then a really big one. What do those represent?
Two